Blog Talk Radio.
Something happened, and then there were double tapes playing. I don't know where the other one came from, but what we're going to do is replay the Eric Hopper Part 1 interview. Is very important because what he said back then in this interview with Eric Severide, which we had in Western Public Radio and KLW Archives and Brazola, Carson Brazola Archives, relates to today with Occupy and the so-called progressives and the New America and all of that political pablum the arrogance of the so-called intellectuals. Here's a guy who taught himself to read. He worked as a longshoreman on San Francisco docks, and he wasn't a phony. I met him in the Albert Henry Bookstore in Burien, San Francisco, when we would both go down on Sundays to get the New York Times, and he would be in there perusing books. And unfortunately, I wasn't in radio at that time in the 70s, and I didn't interview him. I didn't know that much about him, but I realized that we had a prophet in our midst, and what he said then relates to today. It's very important. Among the events today, on July 27th, the Navigation Act of British Parliament passed that. For those of you who smoke, you can thank Walter Raleigh. Sir Walter Raleigh brought back tobacco, which he discovered when he came to the Americas. He brought it back to England, and they set up what they call these smoke houses and various habit, which some people, even to this day, think it's a disgusting practice. The Bank of England in 1694 was chartered on this date. And keep in mind that this guy Soros, who came from who changed his name, who was Jewish, he never practiced or rejected his faith, and made his wealth off of the blood assets of his fellow Jews in Hungary. And his controversy claims that he tried to break the Bank of England. That's where his money came from. Very controversial person. He doesn't belong in the United States and should be deported, in the opinion of a lot of true Americans who are concerned about these people who come here claiming to contribute, but in fact come to co-opt and corrupt. One of my 1784 U.S. Congress set up the Department of Foreign Affairs, or the U.S. State Department. In 1836, the beautiful city of Adelaide, Australia, in South Australia, was founded. I had been there and had did some interviews there, and when I was a correspondent in Australia, and we'll play some of those. We have already played some of those. I was in Perth, Adelaide, Sydney, and also in Auckland, New Zealand. In 1861, the little Mac, General McClellan, also known as Union Army's Napoleon, he took command of the Army of the Potomac, and he Lincoln could never get this guy to commit or to move, and so Lincoln, in his frustration, went through several generals and finally ended up with General Grant, who they claimed had an alcoholic problem. In 1866, the first communication between North America and Europe, the Atlantic Cable, was laid. It covered 1,686 miles, and I believe that, if I remember my history studies, that in World War I, before the United States entered the war, or that war, that the British had spliced into the cable and in effect hacked it to get information about what the Germans, the Kaiser's government, was doing in America, try to persuade America to go after, or Mexico rather, the infamous Zimmerman telegraph. And a guy named William Stevenson, who was British intelligence man here in the United States. He operated out of New York. One of the most famous spies in world history. And English are very good at spying. Goes back to Queen Elizabeth's time, Queen Elizabeth I. 1909, Orville Wright successfully flew the test flight of the first airplane for the United States Army. And the Army Air Corps was the predecessor of today's United States Air Force. After World War II, the Army Air Corps was split off, and the United States Air Force was set up. And, of course, their headquarters, or their campus, like West Point or Annapolis, is in Colorado. I don't know how far it is from Aurora. In 1918, Saucony, which stands for Standard Oil of New York, which was set up by Rockefeller, developed the first concrete barge to carry oil. What Rockefeller did was he set up all of these Standard Oils in various states and business entities. There was Saucony, Standard Oil of New York, which later became Mobil, Standard Oil of New Jersey, Standard Oil of Indiana, which covered the Midwest, and what we had out here, Chevron. 1919, in Chicago, there was one of the worst riots in America. 500 people were involved or were injured. 23 blacks were killed and 18 whites. During World War I, there was no Olympic Games, and also during World War II, there was no Olympic Games. So tonight, the Olympic Games start in Britain, England, and of course the Lord Mayor says they're ready, so we shall see what we shall see. And we're going to see if the Americans dip their flag. We'll find out Monday when I play the Monday show. In 1941, the Japanese invaded what was French Indochina. Now, the French army and French government, French military were there, and so they were allowed to stay and to administer under the guidance of the Japanese authorities and military. And, of course, the French there were Vichy French. We don't know if there were any French resistance in Indochina during World War II. Okay, and then in 1944, not very many people know this, but the British successfully flew their first jet airplane in combat called the Gloucester Meteor. I don't have a picture of those, but we'll put it up when we do. In 1953, an armistice was signed, ending the Korean War, and of course, General Dwight Eisenhower, who was the Republican candidate for president in 1952, his campaign theme was, "I will go to Korea," and end the war, in effect. And in 1954, Vietnam, or what was French Indochina, was split into two countries. There was North Vietnam and South Vietnam. And this Ho Chi Minh felt this was a betrayal because he wanted there to be one Vietnam, and he was to be the president or the leader. And in 1955, Austria, which had been annexed via Anschluss by Nazi Germany, had been occupied by the four powers, Russia, United States, Britain, and France. They, the four powers withdrew, and Austria regained its independence as an independent country. Okay, and then among the other events, in 1974, President Richard Nixon was impeached. And those of you who remember the first computer, in 1988, Radio Shack introduced what was called the Tandy 1000, I think it was 154. And now we're going to play that interview, which was screwed up on Wednesday, which is the interview with Eric Hoffer, part one. We're going to do the whole series.
Eric Hoffer, the passion mind. Hoffer lives in one room in the Chinese section of San Francisco. No telephone, no bill or TV, no easy chair. His own files and a few books, a folding bed. Retired now as a longshoreman, he walks almost every day through Golden Gate Park, about 2.5 miles. He sees or hears some little thing. An idea begins to be born. He may jot down a short note about it. A special set of muscles in his brain holds the idea, refines it, maybe for a week, a month, a year, before he writes it out in a paragraph. Then one day, people here and abroad read it with a startled sense of recognition that this is original, profound, and simple. Some people call it genius. One day this summer, we had a talk.
Now, Mr. Hoffer, I've always wondered, why you kept on as a laborer after you became a very successful and established writer in this country?
Well, I never became a successful writer. I could never earn my living writing. And I'm not a writer, Mr. Severide. I'm never sure I could write anything. If you think as things through to the bitter end, there isn't much to say. But I do my affairs in the country. There isn't a thought that I can express into my language. And you can't earn a living writing 200.
Mr. Hoffer, everybody has a kind of a sort of mechanical process in which one arrives at his ideas. Does manual labor start something going in your mind, leave your mind free to think abstractly? How does it work?
I think some of the most original ideas I had, Mr. Severi, came to me while I was working. And you know what a glorious feeling it is. Here you work, you talk with your partner. And in the back of your head, you compose sentences. That's when life is glorious. You have two sides of your head, you know. Oh, it's a feeling that nothing you could surpass this glory, you know, of being able all day long to compose sentence by sentence. And then you come home in the evening, and before you even wash your hands, you sit down, and it's all there. It's a glorious thing. I get the longshoreman mad when I said, I just tell him, you know, I can't think of anything more exciting than going to bed with a half-finished paragraph.
A half-finished paragraph.
And that's it. It's true. Imagine, you take a half-finished paragraph, you go to bed with it, and in the morning, can you think of anything more salubrious, more helpful, more glorious, to sit up in your bed and the first thing to think about is the other half of the paragraph? Your day is made!
We're good. Pretty life. Powerful thing, sir.
Oh. Their power, you know, they destroy, they revive, they are dying. And you know, in my case, again, being practically literate, you know, I actually never, I had the only way I learned to write is by seeing how other people write. I feel, whenever I read, this is my chief preoccupation. How did he do? I'm still learning. And I'm never sure I know how to write. And you know, when I wrote this, when I finished this little book, the Emperor of our time, I sent it to my new editor, a very fine person, a very bright person. But you know, and he mixed the quality with quantity, and he sent me a letter, Mr. Hoffer, couldn't we thicken it a little bit? I mean, add something, make it a little bigger? I didn't get mad. I wrote my letter, dear Mr. McRae. I said, the book had 6 chapters. Each chapter had at least 1 original idea. So you have 6 original ideas. Each chapter has at least 2 good sentences. Add it up, you have 6 original ideas. 12 good sentences. Now, when I find a book, even at 1,000 pages, thick that has 6 original ideas, 12 good sentences, I celebrate for a month. And it's a fact. Right now, as I get older, how hard is it to find anything that will fetch you? If I get just 1 little sentence in my book, I'll remember the book to the end of my life.
Well, now, how do your friends on the waterfront really look at you, knowing you write books?
Oh, every longshoreman knows that if he tried hard enough, he could write like Shakespeare. Everybody will. How often have I been told by longshoremen that if they did what I do, which is that the moment there's no work, you have your nose in print and matter, they could write.
Well, when I was young and used to work in gangs and teams and one thing or another, the idea that I was kind of a kid writer, newspaper man, a pseudo-intellectual or something, that used to create a certain alienation.
But I am one of them. They know that I am one of them. See? I am really average. If you want to know how the average longshoreman is going to vote on anything, you ask me. They're going to vote exactly the way I'm going to vote. Not because I propagandize them, because I'm one of them. I just happen to be interested in ideas. What's wrong with that? I think you could be a Michelangelo and still be plain working. This is what I am, and they know that no matter how many books I write, I'm still one of them. All my reactions, there's never been a feeling of separation. They know that I don't want to go anywhere, that if I had the choice to hold it in China, I would never change. I would never go anywhere.
I can't understand how you can make this two sides of your nature in your life operate. You work with these people, you can sit down, drink a beer with them, you're just like them, they take you as one of them. On the other hand, you're seeing them in a different way.
Well, you assume that these people are not intelligent, or let's say intellectual. Let me tell you, these people are tremendously intelligent. And there isn't an idea in the world that I couldn't discuss with these people. I remember when I wrote The Tomb Believer, one night I wrote the only poetical section in that cold book that you call it cold. I don't call it cold at all. It was the chapter on things which are not. You remember that section that from the beginning of time, men fought most desperately for cities yet to be built and gardens yet to be planted. And in the morning I was full of it and I had to talk to somebody. And I went to work with a Negro in the hall and I talked to him. And he caught on to it. It turned out that he was a preacher. And next Sunday he preached on things which are not. Or take this instance. In January, I received a help letter from a telegram from Harvey Shapiro at the New York Times. And here comes February the 14th, Brotherhood Day, and they haven't got an article. Would I write an article on Brotherhood of Men? Ah, well, I never thought about Brotherhood of Men. I never had a thought of it. Now, I like Harvey Shapiro. If I can't do anything for him, I'll do it. So I started to think on it, and I had the first sentence read. It's much easier to love humanity as a whole than to love one's neighbor. Mm-hmm. And so my article was not going to be about the brotherhood of men, but the love of neighbor. Now, every longshoreman is a neighbor. Yeah. So I had to find out what it takes to love your neighbor. And that whole article was discussed on the company's time, right under the hook, on the stringer. And they wrote it.
You know, you write with a kind of icy objectivity. You talk with quite a different tone. How do you explain it?
I don't know about the icy objectivity there. You try to be fair, and you try to write the best way you know. I don't feel that I'm full of ice or anything like that. I'm full of passion, actually. And if I wasn't a passionate person, if I didn't have a passionate state of mind, how the heck would I write about mass movements? How would I write a book in a passionate state of mind? How the heck do I know anybody about it unless he has it in it? And you see, this is a fantastic thing, Mr. Sherman. I had Hitler, Stalin, I had all the murderers in it. Nothing that man has ever done or thought is foreign to me. You know, told you about Goethe saying that he had never heard of a crime that he couldn't commit. There are crumbs of everything inside of us. And all you have to do is be acquainted with yourself and you know the whole world.
Mr. Hoffer, you've written a great deal about leisure.
Doesn't it seem to you that free time now is the privilege of
everybody,
more of the working class? The higher you go to business,
absolutely,
the less time you have.
Of course, America is for the poor, Mr. Severide. Only we have a good time in this country. The rich have it much better elsewhere, better service, more deference. Even Russia, the rich are better off than they are here. And certainly the intellectuals are better off everywhere else. You know, it's the only people who really feel at home in this country are the common people. America is God's gift to the poor. For the first time in history, the common people could do things on their own. Oh, this is, nobody mentions it. We are business civilization, this civilization, but this is the only mass civilization that ever was. The masses, Mr. Severide, eloped with history to America. And we have been living in common law marriage with it, you know, without the incantations of the intellectuals there.
We will have part two of this whole series of interviews probably Monday. So our political anecdote, historical anecdote, again, about American presidents, will be, is this, that Eisenhower on this date, or not on this date, but when the armistice, when they achieved the armistice because of what they called a police action in Korea, Eisenhower's campaign, one of his slogans was, "I will go to Korea," and he did. And, of course, he was able, and, of course, the United States was able to end the conflict, but we still kept troops there even today, and people like Congressman Ron Paul and others have raised the issue that, hey, the Koreans, the South Koreans can defend themselves. We've given them enough military equipment and training, as same as with the Chinese nationalists on Formosa. We'll have more of those on continuing from the book that I wrote, Political Anecdotes. Not Political Anecdotes, but Political Animals, the Political Animal. Now, this has come up again. Somebody I knew when I worked doing research in the San Francisco assessor, recorder's, and tax collector's office, that the assessor at that time during the 80s was a guy named Bruce Jameson. He got caught on a vote fraud. He lived in Alameda County, where incidentally the Alameda Naval Air Base was located at the time. And he took his homeowners over there. That's how you tell where you really live when you own a house. But he was also registered to vote in San Francisco, where he worked, San Francisco County, which is a separate county, and he was an official of the county. Well, he got caught and was fired and was supposed to be prosecuted. Well, he decided to go to Russia. This was about the time the wall came down, and to teach the Russians about property ownership, since the government owned everything over there since the time of the Russian Revolution. But I was told there's some new scandals involved Interpol, $500,000 that are missing, and some other things. But we've heard recently that the Putin government has decided to curb these NGOs, these non-government organizations, and, quote, nonprofits. And the nonprofits here in America increasingly are becoming political organizations, political machines. You know, they're organized, a lot of them are very well organized, and this is the perfect resource for politicians who are illegally using nonprofits for political activity and to register voters and to get them to the polls and all of that. And also there's a lot of corruption, which I've exposed in Easy Pickings. And regrettably, maybe I shouldn't have done this at the time, but I was requested by the FBI to do a flowchart on the affordable housing corporations here in Northern California and their connections around the country. And that flowchart is available. It's up on Amicus Veritas YouTube, but we'll redo it so it's more discernible. And also federal officials in Washington. There was a meeting in 1993 where I was back there. During, it was a snowy, only time I've been to Washington, and we discussed what was really going on with these bogus nonprofits, affordable housing organizations. As for Joran Vandersloot, now I knew a purser who worked on these Caribbean cruise ships, and he told me, incidentally, he was gay, Nick Rommel, that it was common knowledge down there in the Caribbean that girls like Natalie Holloway and others, even boys, were kidnapped and sold into homosexual or slavery, prostitution, and when these kids, which ended up in the Middle East and in places like Thailand, when they were no longer useful, couldn't, in a word, put out, they were put out of their misery and their organs were harvested. This is the new scandal. In fact, I think it was Walsh on who has this program on TV about these missing criminals. He has brought this up a number of times. And also the photos which I put up on, I will put them up again. There were three Vandersloot boys. Two of them were featured in a photo exposition and were called the pimp. So there's the question that was Vandersloot, Joran Vandersloot, pimping for his father. His father was arrested, but he dropped dead of a heart attack. So that's, and of course, Joran Vandersloot murdered this Peruvian girl, and he's in a Peruvian jail, and maybe he will be extradited to the United States for trying to extort money from Natalie Hollywood's mother. Back to public policy, we've learned that Davis, California, where the University of California, Davis, or Cal Allegheny, is located, very nice town, it's south of Sacramento, the state capital, they license bicycles and they also enforce the rules of the roads. So we're trying to get the stats on Davis, and so we will publish that in our upcoming Amicus Veritas YouTube site. So I advise you to go to Amicus, AmicusVeritas, and we will update all of the work that we've been doing on political animals and also famous and infamous sites that people are asking me about. So in with our usual thing, politics and poker. We'll be back Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too.
Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big Ace.
Ace Betts.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush. Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How about we should make Jack Riley the guy?
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of Jack, better.
Which is more important?
Paraphrase.
Well, which is more important? Come back Monday at 4 p.m. This is Peter Paul Rizzola. Have a pleasant weekend. Good night. And we'll be up. This will be up on our Amicus Veritas blog talk, The New Shadow, and go to our Amicus Veritas YouTube site. Good night.